First of all, before I start, I just want to, can you bear with me? I just want to actually bring up my notes. Yeah. Can you still hear me?
I can still hear you. You want to be called Joe and not Giuseppe, do you?
It's easier that way. It's easier to spell, and most people call me Joe. It makes no odds what you call me. I've been called all sorts of names, most of them printable. So that's fine. Right, sir, if I have your permission, I would like to begin. Now, this disquisition is based on my master's dissertation for the MA in philosophy for the Open University. Now, the title of my dissertation is, if you bear with me, I can't remember it now, get my notes up. It's a long time since I've done it. It is, let's have a look, bear with me. Things go wrong, they do go wrong. Right. George Sorrell, philosopher of the barricades or moralist? A critique of Anna Arendt's contention that Sorrell, quote, glorified violence for violence's sake. And it's also a defense of Sorrell's reflections on violence. And before I actually launch forth into it, obviously need to let you know that I drew upon quite a number of works. And before I actually start, I'll go through the works I've drawn upon so that when I actually go through my presentation, you know what I'm on about, I'm referring to. Well, obviously, first of all, Anna Arendt. She wrote a little book called On Violence in 1969. I also draw her work On Revolution, of the same title. I draw upon the work of Henry Bergson, the philosopher who wrote Time and Free Will. Also an essay by Isaiah Berlin on George Sorrell that was published in the Times Literary Supplement in 1971. I also draw upon Edward Bernstein, who wrote Evolutionary Socialism. And also American author called Brandom, who wrote an essay called Violence in Translation. George Sorrell, Liberalism and Totalitarianism from Weimar to Woodstock. And there's another work as well I draw upon, and that is Violence and Resistance to the State, George Sorrell's Reflections on Violence. And you'll have to forgive my mispronunciation here with foreign names, Chicarilio Mahe on Decolonizing Dialectics, Duong, The Virtues of Violence, Finley, Hannah Arendt's Critique of Violence, Frankel, The Dual State, A Contribution to the Theory of Dictatorship, Hughes, Consciousness and Society, The Reorientation of European Social Thought, 1890 to 1930. Bear with me. Jennings, George Sorrell, The Character and Development of His Thought, Kahn, Myth and Reality in Sorrell, Kolakowski, Main Currents of Marxism, McDonough and Drago, Crises of Capitalism and the First Crisis of Marxism, A Theoretical Note on the Bernstein-Kautsky Debate, McInnes, George Sorrell, Ohana, George Sorrell and the Rise of Political Myth, Rune, Irrationalism and Myth in George Sorrell, Schlesinger, America, 1968, The Politics of Violence, and last but not least, Sorrell himself, The Socialist Future of the Syndicates, and Reflections on Violence. I used several editions for this, several translations. And is the Illusions of Progress, his Decomposition of Marxism, and Sternhell, The Birth of Fascist Ideology from Cultural Rebellion to Political Revolution. And finally, Voot and Wild, Socialism and Myth, The Case of Sorrell and Bergson. Now, my dissertation, this talk, is both a critique of Arendt's contention vis-à-vis Sorrell's reflections on violence and a defence of the latter. I first of all attempt to situate Arendt's critique in terms of the Anglo-German response towards Sorrell. In other words, looking at Weimar, the diaspora of German intellectuals, including Arendt, who influenced scholarship pertaining to Sorrell both pre- and post-war, and the concerns raised in the 1960s by both Arendt and Schlesinger. Now, Arendt's response to Sorrell's reflections on violence is critiqued by means of Finley, a philosopher, and the latter identifies both common ground and differences between Arendt and Sorrell regarding their conception of violence. I then go on to consider more sympathetic examination of Sorrel by two thinkers, Eisenhower and Berlin, the well-known philosopher and Cold War warrior, and McInnes, who was a scholar of Sorrel, another French thinkers as well. Now, both adopt a more nuanced approach towards Sorrel's approach towards violence, and they emphasise his role as a moralist. And finally, I attempt to situate Sorrel in both his historical and philosophical context. Now, regarding the historical context, I will contextualise Sorrel vis-à-vis the debates concerning decadence in the Third French Republic. As for the philosophical milieu, particular influence will be focused on the influence of Bergson, the crisis in Marxism occasioned by Bernstein's revisionism, and Sorrel's anti-Jacobinism. It will be concluded that Sorrel presented by Arendt is at odds with the Sorrel presented his own words in Reflections and the work of scholars, of Sorrel scholars. I'm basically arguing that Sorrel's examination of violence is more nuanced than Arendt allows, and moreover, it is infused with moral purpose. So let's just proceed. I mean, set the background, as it were. You know where I'm coming from. Right, allow me time. Okay, just getting there. I have to scroll through. Right, okay. As I said, the title of the dissertation, and my presentation, indicates both a critique of Arendt's claim and a defence of Sorrel's Reflections on Violence. Now, Sorrel is a highly contentious figure in political philosophy. It puts me very much in mind of the responses to Machiavelli and Marx. In other words, they're more reviled than read. And when they are read, they tend to be misunderstood, and sometimes willfully so. Now, Jennings cites J.B. Priestley, the novelist, dramatist, sage, and professional Yorkshireman, who opined, quote, that if one could grasp why a retired civil servant, i.e. Sorrel, has written such a book, Reflections on Violence, then the modern age would be understood. Moreover, Jennings notes that Reflections, I quote, heralded the political turmoil of the decades that followed and provided inspiration for Marxists and fascists alike. Regarding Marxists, now both Gramsci and Togliatti, who was leader of the Italian Socialist Party, actually, were influenced and were quite respectful of Sorrel. But Lenin took a rather low opinion of him. He referred to him as a muddlehead. Regarding fascism, he is viewed by some as being the intellectual godfather of fascism. I mean, Mussolini makes much use of, makes much comment about having been inspired by Sorrel. Now, the dissertation is, and my presentation here, is both an attempt at addressing Priestley's challenge and also a considered riposte to Arendt's assertion alluded to in the dissertation's title. Now, first of all, as I said, I'll be situating Arendt's views on Sorrel's Reflections vis-à-vis the changing responses to Sorrel in the 20th century. And this is informed by the works of Brandom and Finlay. I will then look at the more sympathetic examinations of Sorrel's Reflections by Berlin and McInnes. I will then attempt to situate Sorrel both historically and philosophically. But throughout, I will submit Arendt's contention to critical scrutiny. Now, Brandom notes that, quote, Sorrel is often invoked in order to indicate a radicalism that fails to make distinctions between left and right, that Sorrel stands for intellectuals who have betrayed the vocation of intellectuals by accepting the wrong type of violence. Those damned by association with the Sorrelian myth confuses means and ends, giving too much space to the non-rational and to an apotheosis of the will. But he contrasts this polemical usage with one situating Sorrel in all his complexity and contradiction as a product of his time and place. And that's what this presentation will attempt to do. Now, Brandom argues that Sorrel invoked in polemics is not the historical Sorrel, but more in the way of a polemical or historiographical construct that he designates as being a transatlantic Sorrel. That is, a construct that emerged out of the matrix of Weimar-era sociological debate and simplified and hardened into an effective tool by emigre scholars. And one can count Arendt as being part of that company. Now, Brandom's fundamental point, and it applies to Arendt, is that This indicates as much about those who made use of it as it is about Sorrell. Furthermore, you know, to the elements drawn directly from Sorrell's texts, affiliations were added several, you know, and text affiliation, sorry, were added several doses of conjecture and anxiety. Now, Brandom's paper is important, for it examines the reception of Sorrell's work from the Weimar context to the American, and includes what Brandom designates the rearguard action against the new socio-political tides of the late 1960s. I have in mind basically, you know, 1968, the year of revolts and what followed from that in the United States and beyond. And Arendt's work on violence is part of this rearguard action. Now, in his examination of the importance of emigre intellectuals and scholars, vis-a-vis the Allied war important, of particular importance regarding Arendt's view of Sorrell is the work of Ernest Frankl. Its work is The Dual State, which was published in 1941. Now, according to Brandom, Frankl views Sorrell as having, quote, transformed Marxism into a myth, because to him, Sorrell, the movement was everything and the goal nothing. The Sorrell became the prophet of politics without an ultimate goal, the advocate of action for the sake of action, end of quote. Furthermore, Frankl cites the example of the German jurist Carl Schmitt, a devotee of Sorrell and, in Frankl's view, the most brilliant political theorist of post-war Germany, whose political trajectory from political Catholicism to National Socialism illustrates the deleterious effects of Sorrell on the generations of Weimar, the political asceticism that worships violence for its own sake. Now, such a view resonates, with Arendt's own assertion regarding Sorrell glorifying violence for violence's sake. Now, regarding the America that emigre scholars and activists such as Arendt found themselves in, Brandom notes that Sorrell were being scrupulously labelled as an ambiguous and tragic, but ultimately pre-totalitarian and dangerous figure in the 1950s, became useful in the 60s. Now, Brandom opines that while scholars might have been guilty of oversimplifying the situation when they described Mussolini's ideology to Sorrell, they could actually draw on concrete, textual and personal connections. However, the same cannot be said regarding the link between Sorrell and the New Left, which was Arendt's target in a polemic on violence. Now, Brandom conceptualised it not so much an example of historical continuity, but more of a conceptual, psychological or political similarity. Now, a case in point is the speech delivered by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who is a historian, a liberal Democrat and a confidant of JFK. And it's a speech that was delivered on the 7th of June, 1968, the day after Robert Kennedy's assassination. Now, Schlesinger deployed Sorrell as a symbol of what he perceived to be the increasing acceptance of political violence in American politics, particularly on the part of the far left. You know, who he sees, and I quote, in the footsteps of Sorrell, the new leftists believe in the omnipotence of the deed and the irrelevance of the goals. Now, Brandom observes that Schlesinger's diatribe echoes the revisionist debate in 19th century Marxism vis-a-vis Bernstein, i.e. the goal is nothing, the movement everything. Now, the relationship between Bernstein and Sorrell is important regarding Sorrell's work, and we'll explore it later on in this presentation. And, you know, when I attempt to situate Sorrell historically and philosophically. Now, furthermore, Brandom notes that Schlesinger establishes a direct connection between Sorrell and Marcuse and Fanon regarding his concern that the New Left were following Sorrell in their, quote, vacating of freedom and reason from politics, and he delivered this Cassandrian judgment. If we abandon this, we abandon everything. Now, for Schlesinger, Sorrell stood as a warning that admitting violence into political struggle always vitiated noble aims, and that the right would also be better at manipulating and wielding violence. Now, Arendt's on violence was a direct response to this perceived political violence. As Brandom observes, her opening pages advance her thesis that the means ends structure implied by acts of violence have been radically altered by the 20th century. For Arendt, all the verities about the relationship between war and politics, about violence and power, have become inapplicable. The Second World War was not followed by a peace, but by a Cold War and the establishment of the military-industrial complex. Now, Arendt perceives Searle's worldview as being an attempt, now quoting her now, to combine Marxism with Bergson's philosophy of life, in other words, vitalism. And as Brandom observes, Arendt cautions that once social struggle is conceived in biological terms, and you know she's referring here to Bergson's Elan Vital, the vitalism, that violence becomes mandatory, even a positive virtue. And she states, nothing in my opinion could be theoretically more dangerous than the tradition of organic thought in political matters. Now, what Brandom terms the political moment of 1968 is viewed by Arendt as the abandonment of real politics, that is, the exercise of power, and that consequently, all that remains is more or less violent refusal. And Arendt puts it thus. The present glorification of violence, bear with me. It's okay, I've just lost my screen went blank there. I'll repeat it again. Yeah, and that Arendt put it thus. The present glorification of violence is caused by severe frustration of the faculty of action in the modern world. End of quote. And as Brandom notes, Arendt views the blockage of real politics having the effect of elevating struggles over material existence into ideology, thus explaining the attraction of Searle's and Fanon's quasi-vitalistic approach to political struggle. Moreover, Arendt identifies the danger of this Bergsonian vitalist approach vis-a-vis violence in, this is to quote Arendt again, in that it confuses the true nature of violence in social conflict, which is basically instrumental, i.e., it is more the weapon of reform rather than revolution, and unintended consequences are likely to occur. And argued that while Searle and Fanon encourage the use of violence in the hope of revolution, the spoils in fact go to reform, and probably not rational reform either, since the use of violence was not rationally planned. And as Brandom further notes, both Arendt and Schlesinger indict Searle for using violence as a means with violence as an end. However, one can argue that this is both a misreading and a misunderstanding of Searle. And such a stance can be discerned in the critique of Arendt's critique of violence advanced by Finlay. Now, Finlay focuses on what he discerns to be the central argument in her argument against Fanon and Searle, i.e., her distinction between instrumental justifications and approaches emphasizing the legitimacy of violence or its intrinsic value. Now, Finlay notes that Arendt did not subscribe to the view that violence is completely without possible utility in context of political action, and evolutionary ones in particular. However, he acknowledges that our view of the events of 1968 is somewhat pessimistic, that some of the most striking passages in her polemic on violence highlight that a standoff between democratic solidarity and the state has lost its power, but not its capacity to coerce, and it will typically see the victory of the forces of reaction. However, Finlay also concedes that Arendt was also adamant that there were occasions when violence is justifiable for the attainment of just ends, ends which were important for politics. As noted by Finlay, Arendt, in examination of violence in the 1960s, and particular in her polemic on violence, was debating with a wide range of different theorists and their followers. And through them, a number of distinct but interconnected propositions. Now, Finlay identifies four, and they can be adumbrated as follows. First, violence is an essential component of power. Second, violence must be handled as being valuable in and of itself. And third, violence is an unavoidable and continual component of political existence that can be viewed as located in or analogous to biological necessity. And fourth, the acceptance of violence is linked to its origins and distinct from its ends. Moreover, the importance of these propositions lie in their interconnectedness. They can be combined in various ways to form more complex arguments. The main argument identified by Finlay vis-a-vis Arendt is a position that if human life is a struggle and if life itself is valorized as a creative principle, then violence can be glorified and seen as intrinsically good, since it expresses the elan vital of life itself, a view aren't associated particularly with sorrow. Moreover, Finlay argues that the propositions can be conceptualized as one of the contexts within which he made a pronouncement on the need to justify violence incrementally. Now, regarding morality, Arendt argues that violence can be justifiable, but it never will be legitimate. Its justification loses its plausibility the further its intended end recedes into the future. As for the rationality of violence, Finlay notes that it is determined by its conduciveness to achieving just ends. Now, Arendt argues thus, I quote, "Violence, being instrumental by nature, is rational to the effect that it is effective in reaching the end that must justify it. And since we then, when we act, we never know with any certainty the consequences of what we are doing, violence can remain rational only if it pursues short-term goals. Moreover, in an introduction on her work on revolution, Arendt contends that, and I quote, a theory of war or of revolution can only deal with the justification of violence because the justification constitutes its political limitation. If instead it arrives at a glorification or justification of violence as such, it is no longer political but apolitical." Now, Finlay identifies instrumental justification as being the main principle by which Arendt differentiates what she considered to be justifiable violence from that of sorrow in the company of Fanon and Wilfredo Pareto, who were allegedly glorified violence for violence's sake, in Arendt's view. However, Finlay cautions that there are some important qualifications to Arendt's endorsement of instrumental justifications in a polemic on violence, and he identifies these as follows. Although Arendt opines that justification is preferable to perspectives that endorse legitimacy, she's adamant that the connection between ends and means is too unpredictable for violence to be a fail-safe political tool. In addition, Finlay points out that Arendt identifies two complications, the arbitrary nature and unpredictability of violence. In the absence of violence, action can be unpredictable. Two, Arendt views violence as being generative. That is, violence has a tendency to undermine, neutralize its purported ends or generate new ends. And she summarizes the deployment of summarizes that the deployment of violence is likely to beget more violence. Now, Arendt considers violence to be detrimental to politics, a position that permeates her polemic on violence, and is also a refrain throughout her published writings. However, Finlay argues that an examination of Searle's ideas demonstrates how Arendt's perspective vis-à-vis violence is more complicated than reading on violence on its own seems to suggest. Now, Finlay posits Arendt citing both Searle and Fanon as examples of glorifying violence for the sake of violence, introducing the elements of legitimacy and necessity as part of their more general approach to the justice of political violence. But he takes the view that the positions were less vulnerable to the line of argument taken in the polemic on violence than Arendt's fairly abrupt dismissal seems to suggest. He observes that both not only advanced legitimist and determinist justifications, but also a further instrumentalist line, which appears to be simpatico with Arendt's position. Now, Finlay begins by indicating the complexities in Searle's perspective that gives lie to Arendt's dismissive comments regarding Searle. He cites the following extracts from Searle's reflections on violence. Quote, "Proletarian violence carried out as a pure and simple manifestation of the sentiment of class struggle appears as a very fine and heroic thing. It's at the service of the immemorial interests of civilization," end of quote. Moreover, Searle recognizes that although it is, this is Searle again, "not perhaps the most appropriate method of obtaining immediate material advantages, it may save the world from barbarism," end of quote. As Finlay observes, this reflects a complexity in Searle's approach in justification that goes beyond Arendt's statement on glorification. Whilst acknowledging that Searle's first remark reflects a view of the glory of revolutionary violence underwritten by the legitimacy of its origins in revolutionary consciousness, the complete meaning of Searle's valorization of violence is only discernible in the second and third propositions. Now, Finlay opines that the second proposition, violence not being the most appropriate method of obtaining material advantages, can be viewed as a rejection of the deployment of violence. Moreover, whilst Arendt conceptualized Sorrell as theorizing class struggle in military terms, in fact, he believed violence that characterized war played a minimal role in revolutionary situations. As Finlay observes, while Sorrell occasionally makes comparisons between class and conventional military warfare, he differs from Clausewitz's approach in that he does not view violence in terms of wrestling concessions from an opponent. And the final tactical confrontation revolution eventually occurs in what Arendt recognized as the essential non-violent act of the proletarian general strike. For Sorrell, the aim of personal violence is to provoke and inspire and to mark what he terms the separation of classes. Sorrell envisages this as a method of moulding the emergence of polarising forces in society, thus facilitating a general strike whereby one force would finally succumb to the other. Moreover, Finlay views Sorrell's first and third propositions as manifesting this, i.e. violence is at the service of the immemorial interests of civilization, and it may save the world from barbarism. Now, Sorrell perceives civilization as being endangered by a barbarous intermixing of the old bourgeoisie and new proletarian orders, each corrupted through compromise with the other. Violent science believed would prevent this from happening. Now, Finlay argues, I've skipped ahead a bit there. Bear with me, please. To find my place again. Yeah, Finlay argues that while Sorrell justifies violence in instrumental terms, it is instrumental in radicalizing political consciousness by preventing government from consolidating power through cautious policy. In short, forms of violence capable of provoking the ruling elements into forceful repression and compelling the bourgeoisie to place historical role in the unfolding drama of capitalist hubris in full. Consequently, a cycle is set in motion whereby violence and repression reinforce proletarian consciousness. Now, Sorrell's glorification of violence is not passe Arendt violence for violence's sake, but takes place within the context of what Finlay sees as Sorrell's wider strategic approach to revolutionary escalation and confrontation, comprising in effect a second element to follow the use of violence in provocation. And as Finlay has previously noted, the utilization of violence differs from the Clausewitzian tactical force. Furthermore, Finlay identifies glorification happening in the context of a theatrical approach to violence. This is where Sorrell's notion of myth comes into play. Now, Finlay views Sorrell's myth as a narrative through which the proletariat could imagine, orientate, and motivate itself in a historical struggle with its enemies. And its uses as an instrument of revolutionary politics lies in the possibility that it can be acted out and dramatized theatrically, thus facilitating the myth of the general strike. In essence, it's a dialectical process. Violence not only reinforces myth and stokes the emotion it generates through glorification, but also develops political consciousness. The point to bear in mind is that violence is not passe Arendt or glorified for its own sake. As Finlay notes, the glorification happens owing to the heroizing of violence as a useful part of political strategy for revolution. And though violence lacks an immediate justification as a tactical military instrument, it is given an instrumental justification mediated through political strategy. One might concur with Finlay's view that if there is a tendency in Sorrell's reflections to glorify violence, it can be warranted by the political ends that theatrical violence can potentially bring about. Consequently, it can be argued that given that Sorrell accounts for the justice of political violence partly in reference to its usefulness in achieving revolutionary goals, it may be defensible in relation to Arendt's argument that justice or rationality of violence is principally a function of its instrumental utility. Now, considering this, Finlay argues that Arendt's attack on Sorrell in the polemic on violence invites the possibility of a partial vindication of Sorrell. Finlay views a key difference between Arendt and Sorrell vis-a-vis violence as being not so much the importance given to instrumental justification, but more in their differing construal of the means-end relation. That is, at its core, Arendt's critique of Sorrell, in his words, instantiates a distinction between two kinds of instrumental justification. First, violence is justified as a tactical military instrument, meeting coercion with coercion. Anything of forces are directed in turn at the negation of emerging possible political possibilities in revolution. Second, violence is an instrument directly and shaping and acting within political possibilities themselves. Sorrell viewed violence as possessing meagre utility regarding the first kind of instrumental justification. Sorrell is more sympathetic with the second kind, animating politics by shaping agents who create it. Herein lies the difference between Arendt and Sorrell's approaches vis-a-vis violence. Now, in contradistinction to Arendt, Isaiah Berlin takes a more sympathetic position towards Sorrell and his oeuvre. He demonstrates an awareness of the nuances of Sorrell's arguments. Regarding the function of violence, Berlin notes, and I quote, "The weapons of the workers is violence." But Berlin also notes that while it gives its name to Sorrell's best work, its nature is now made clear. Class conflict is a normal condition of society, and force is continually exerted against the producers, that is, the workers by the exploiters. Moreover, Berlin argues that force is not necessarily manifested in open coercion, but control and repression by means of institutions, which, whether by design or not, have the effect of promoting the power of the possessing class. Moreover, this force must be resisted. Berlin notes that in Sorrell's lexicon, force is differentiated from violence. The function of proletarian violence is not aggression but resistance. It is the striking off of the chains, the prelude to regeneration. In other words, the renewal of life, rejuvenation, the liberation of creative powers, the return to Homeric simplicity, the spirit of the early Christian martyrs, the French revolutions. And this cannot be attained by persuasion without violence as the weapon of liberty. However, Berlin notes the lack of clarity regarding how one differentiates between violence and force, and conjectures that, and I quote, "the distinction between force and violence appears to depend on the character of its functions and motive. Force imposes chains, violence breaks them. Force opens or conceals enslaved and enslaves. Violence also makes free." However, as Berlin observes, these concepts, force and violence, are metaphysical, not empirical concepts. The point being that Sorrell is a moralist, and his values are, in Berlin's view, rooted in one of the oldest of human traditions, and why his theses do belong not only to their own times, but retain their freshness. And like Arendt, Berlin observes how Sorrell's ideas resonate with the wave of unrest that marked the late 60s and early 70s. And he notes that Fanon, like Sorrell, is cited by Arendt as an example of advocating violence for the sake of violence. Fanon's concerned about poverty, suffering, and inequality was not at the centre of Sorrell's moral vision, but they would have fulfilled his ideal of revolutionary pride, of a will moved by absolute moral values. However, Berlin also cautions that Sorrell believed in self-restraint and self-discipline, and that he hated disorder, bohemianism, the lack of self-imposed barriers as symptoms of self-indulgence and decadence. And this resonates with Kolakowski, who characterized Sorrell's moral philosophy as Jansenist Marxism, and conjectures that Sorrell's Jansenist upbringing gave him a dislike of any optimistic faith in the natural goodness of mankind, and his contempt for Jesuitical tactics of conciliation, his general intransigence, the all-or-nothing rejection of compromise, and in opposition to the doctrine of automatic progress, as outlined in Sorrell's The Illusions of Progress. In that he was attached to the tradition of radical Christianity, the Christianity of the martyr. Now, going back to Berlin, Berlin emphasizes that the strongest single link with the revolutionary movement of the 60s and 70s, one might also cite the more recent Occupy movement, is the unyielding emphasis on the will. Now, Sorrell emphasized absolute moral ends, independent of any dialectical or other historical pattern. and the possibility of realizing these ends by the concerted power of the free and deliberate collective will. However, Berlin further notes, Sorrel prized only absolute values, total independence, and he casts Sorrel in the role of a modern Diogenes, bent on exploding the most sacred dogmas and respected beliefs of his enlightened age. Now, McInnes, like Berlin, takes a more sympathetic view of Sorrel's reflections and errant, and observes, and I quote, "It is not Sorrel's philosophical system that has preserved his name and relevance, but the notions of myth and violence." Of particular importance to McInnes is Sorrel's attack on, quote, "the hypocrisy of intellectualism regarding the prevailing discourse and violence." Sorrel's point being that violence is not reprehensible per se, and that myths are immune to refutation. McInnes views Sorrel's reflections as answering the accusation that any movement resulting to violence was ipso facto condemned as evil and retrograde. The reflections question what McInnes terms the confident Edwardian belief that civilization necessarily required peaceful settlement of all disputes, and as humanity progressed, it moved near social international peace. Moreover, bear with me, I've skipped ahead again to this cursor. Yep, moreover, unlike Arendt, McInnes argues that Sorrel did not preach indiscriminate violence, but highlighted the hypocrisy that permeated the dominant discourse pertaining to violence. McInnes views Sorrel as drawing attention to the ubiquity of violence in society, and opined that it displayed no sign of disappearing. Moreover, violence in the form of warfare and law and order is tolerated, while odium is heaped upon oppositional violence. And he posits Sorrel as asking for violence to be contextualized. In other words, asking who is carrying out the violent acts, and consider whether it is not associated, as so often in the history of civilization, with progressive and heroic morality that is ruthlessly forcing recognition of its independence and its rejection of mediocrity. And regarding Sorrel's notion of myth, McInnes argues that Sorrel observed that social movements, quote, "construct sanguinary legends regarding the violence they've endured, and that such bloodthirsty traditions are true only symbolically. The grain of truth in them is a few clashes that proved a readiness to go to extremes." In short, McInnes cites Sorrel as arguing that real violence means going to the ends of one's ideas. Furthermore, he emphasizes that Sorrel, whilst not apropos Arendt, advocates violence for violence's sake, regards any notion of violence never being utilized to advance estimable causes as being naive. McInnes is in accord with the sentiments expressed by Sorrel when he opines, opines that violence can be lucid, noble, and applied to the defense of higher purpose. And McInnes cites examples of national liberation movements, arguing that since these movements implicitly invoked Sorrel in their apologies for violence, his reflection contributed to that evolution. There's not a line in his work to condone systematic violence or violence applied otherwise than by a progressive morality of liberty. And this morality will be examined further on in my presentation. Okay, I will now attempt to, if you like, situate Sorrel historically and philosophically. Now, Duong views reflections of violence as formalizing, quote, "the reason why proletarian violence could renew the moral basis of society." And he contrasts Sorrel with Emil Durkheim, the sociologist, the latter being regarded as influencing France's Third Republic's statist, technocratic approach to social progress and moral improvement. Moreover, Duong emphasizes Sorrel's debt to Bergson vis-a-vis the search for the sources of moral improvement in immediate experience. Duong opines that Bergson aided Sorrel in formulating an anti-statist alternative achieving similar ends, the alternative being a mythic proletarian violence situated in the preconceptual mythic dimensions of class struggle, and possessing morally productive powers absent in the instrumental force of the state, and contrasted with the familiar problems with French republican citizenship, i.e. atomizing rather than associating, thus leading France into moral decadence. Now, Drouin argues that Sorel established a causal link between political violence and moral renovation. Workers could generate a new morality for a world dying from utilitarian reason. Furthermore, Drouin observes that while Sorel posited the proletariat as being in exclusive possession of redemptive violence, his argument was reinterpreted in nationalist terms as it travelled from text to context. And Drouin argues that Sorel's reflections on violence should not be viewed as an aberration vis-à-vis the democratic political culture of the Third French Republic, and that claims to irrational violence responded to a real contradiction contained in the Third Republic's republicanism. In other words, its abstract vision of the social body could not bridge its conflicting commitments to individual and social cohesion. Now, he cites irrationalist redemptive violence as appearing to provide an entry point into the moral society that the French Republican tradition had stipulated as a requirement for peoplehood, was a reason why the leading lights of French thought, like May in the fall of 1914, could find in the World War an occasion for spiritual salvation. And one conjectures that Sorel's reflections appeared what he calls an inflection point in oppositional politics under the Third Republic. Now, he cites the escalating anti-clericalism that coexisted with mounting working-class militancy. And when Sorel entered the lists on behalf of revolutionary syndicalism in the early 1900s, the latter, revolutionary syndicalism, had been on the increase for nearly two decades. However, Drouin also draws attention to the fact that following closely from the publication of Reflections, Sorel and his fellow syndicalists were courted by figures from the Catholic right. For example, Georges Valois, who found the extremist nationalist Cercle Proudhon, later Le Fascheux, a short-lived fascist party, Amoura, head of Action Française, a monarchist party, detected possible grounds for relationship between revolutionary syndicalism and royalist nationalism. Drouin notes that this proposed union was more than a marriage of convenience, that the Catholic right required the support of organized labor in its challenge to what can be termed the liberal republican establishment. And Sorel and the syndicalists anathematized by the parliamentary socialists led by Juras. But given by the date of publication of Reflections in 1908, the parliamentary left had parted company of the revolutionary left. The shared ground between syndicalism and the far right was, according to Drouin, philosophical, a shared interest in a new idiom of social criticism that combined traditional platitudes of church and family and contemporary French philosophy concerned with intuition, immediate experience, and the will, the latter being vitalism, the philosophy of Bergson. As Drouin observes, whilst Bergson did not convert his philosophy into a sustained language of social criticism, his admirers, Sorel being among their number, weaponized Bergson's arguments. And as Hughes noted, the quote, Bergsonism was living a life of its own, almost independently of its founder, something like a Frankenstein's monster. An example of this being political Bergsonism. Now, Sorel can be viewed as exemplifying this. And Vaught and Lawrence, writing in their Radical Philosophy, which itself, Radical Philosophy, the journal, was a result of the ferment of 1968, concur with the sentiment when they argue that, and I quote, whilst Bergson's philosophy contained no social theory, the immense acclaim which his philosophy received encouraged some sort of social application, and it supplied Sorel with its inspiration and confidence to make such an attempt. Both Bergson and Sorel were sceptical of the prevailing scientific rationality. And this can be discerned in Sorel's The Illusion of Progress. I quote him from him. He says, today, the idea that everything can be subjected to a perfectly clear analysis is about as strong as it was in Descartes' time. If someone considers making a protest against the illusion of rationalism, he is immediately accused of being an enemy of democracy. I've often heard people who pride themselves on working for progress, deploring the works of Bergson, and pointing them as the greatest danger confronting modern thought. Now, Vaught and Wilde argue that both Bergson and Sorrell can be deemed to dismiss rationalism's universal claims, but not retreating into romanticism. And also opine that Bergson is more than a footnote in Sorrell's history of social myth, expanded in Reflections on Violence. Now, Sorrell's reference to Bergson's philosophy intuition are central and explicit, and the style is imbued with Bergsonian traces. And this is particularly evident in the notion of myth. As Vaught and Wilde indicate, Sorrell is insistent that the images which encompass myth can be generated by intuition alone, in a manner whereby the soul of the revolutionaries may receive a deep and lasting impression. Now, Vaught and Wilde observe that socialism is reduced to the drama, you know, we have the theatricality again, of the general strike, as I said, echoing Finlay's notion of theatrical violence. And they cite Sorrell's opinion that this approach has all the advantages which integral knowledge has over in analysis, according to the doctrine of Bergson. Furthermore, Sorrell cites Bergson to support his argument that a corpus of thought such as socialism can only be effectively apprehended if myth performs a catalytic function. That is, to quote Sorrell, true and fruitful ideas are so many close contacts with currents of reality, and we do not obtain an intuition from reality, that is an intellectual sympathy, with the most intimate of it, unless we have won its confidence by a long fellowship with its superficial manifestation. Moreover, Sorrell opined that this is exemplified what he termed the new school of revolutionary syndicalism, that is a movement of the people rather than simply for the people. And Vaught and Wilde draw attention to Sorrell's letter to Daniel Halevy in July 1907 that forms introduction to Reflections, in which he cites approvingly Bergson's idea of the rare moment of deep introduction in which we receive true freedom and get back into pure duration. And how Sorrell replies this notion to the social sphere, deploying the idea of myth to encapsulate the occasion when the proletariat are profoundly influenced. An event that is akin to Bergson's free act of the individual, an indispensable requirement in the construction of a socialist movement. And Vaught and Wilde cite Sorrell's belief that an absence of myths will amount to little more than a succession of revolts. And this is what gives such importance to the general strike and renders it so odious to socialists. He's referring to the reformist socialists in Parliament, who are afraid of a revolution. Now, Sorrell's notion of myth merits further examination, particularly with regard to Sorrell's relation with Marxism. Pardon me. According to Sternhell, Sorrell viewed Marxism as a receptacle that could be voided of its original contents and filled with another substance. This principle applied not only to the means, but also the ends of political action. Furthermore, Sternhell observes that whilst Marxism has its roots in 18th century rationalism, Sorrell's revision of Marxism replaced the rationalist Hegelian foundation of Marxism with Le Bon's vision of human nature. Now, Le Bon is Gustave Le Bon, who was a pioneer of the social psychology of the crowd. He actually wrote a book called The Crowd, which had a profound influence on not only the discipline of social psychology, but also demagogues such as Mussolini and Hitler. Yeah, with Le Bon's vision of human nature, with the anti-Cartesianism of Bergson, with the Nietzschean cult of revolt, and with Pareto's most recent discoveries in political science. Now, Sternhell, and me, conceptualized this as Sorrell's way of transcending what was perceived as a crisis in Marxism. This was raised by Bernstein's critique of Bernstein, of orthodox Marxism. Bernstein argued that the economy was becoming less conflict-ridden, He denied capitalism's tendency to concentration and centralization on empirical grounds, e.g., with the advent of joint stock companies, capital ownership was being diffused to greater and greater segments of the population. Moreover, this is the important bit, in regard to Sorrell, he emphasized the importance of ethics. For Bernstein, it was the development of ethics rather than class struggle, which signified the movement towards socialism. This was supposed to take place through the vehicle of liberal democracy. Sternhell notes that Sorrell, driven by his interest in the ethical aspect of Marxism, drew close to the liberal revisionist current of the type represented by Bernstein. He approved a return to Kant that seemed to be taking place in Germany. Sternhell emphasized that Sorrell took up Marxism with enthusiasm, stuck with it faithfully, because he perceived a moral content that was important to him. Sorrell made it clear that socialism is a moral question in so much as it provides the world with a new way of judging all human acts, or to use Nietzsche's famous expression, with a total re-evaluation of all things. Consequently, the critique of Marxist economics was a real starting point of revolutionary revisionism. Regarding this, Sternhell draws attention to Sorrell's The Decomposition of Marxism, a text that is correlative to Reflections. In it, Sorrell states that Marxism is closely related to the faction of political economics called Manchesterian, as in Manchester, which divides society into two classes between which there is no connection, and cautions that democracy can work effectively to prevent the progress of socialism. The implication being that to remain true to Marxism entailed going back to basics, the promotion of class struggle. As previously noted, Sorrell appropriated the revisionist method from Bernstein, the means but not the content. As Sternhell further observes, in The Decomposition, Sorrell's revolutionary, anti-rationalist and mythical revisionism is predicated on what Sorrell perceived to be a stratum of Marxist thought not previously suspected, the symbolic parts, formerly regarded of doubtful value, class struggle and the final catastrophe. Now, these are viewed by Sorrell as forming the core of Marxist doctrine. Class struggle and the final catastrophe are the two main principles of Sorrell's interpretation of Marxism, but are explicated by means of sentiments, myths and images. Sorrell asks us to contemplate the history of the Roman Catholic Church as an object lesson. And Sorrell opines that the role of the revolutionary syndicates that saved socialism, to be compared to the religious orders in their rejuvenation of the old Catholic edifice. Now, Sorrell can be deemed to have adopted a pragmatic, utilitarian approach to Marxism. A deep knowledge of Marxist philosophy and economics were never necessary to understand the value of Marxism as a weapon of combat. As Sorrell declared himself, the theory of surplus value is useless in the ceaseless war of the bourgeois proletariat. The implication being, in the words of Sternhell, people do not sacrifice themselves for surplus value. As noted, Sorrell believed that the essence of Marxism lay in the symbolic and apocalyptic content of the system. Moreover, Sternhell emphasizes that Sorrellian revisionism was located in the social reality of his time, an immediate environment. It was not a mere intellectual exercise. Sorrell constructed his mythical and apocalyptical interpretation of Marxism in Reflections against a backdrop of actual industrial strife. Brandom cites the large regional strike that follows an explosion on March the 10th, 1906. However, one should be cognizant of the wider context in which Sorrell wrote Reflections. While there's an increase in labour militancy and sanguinary stands off of the state, in parallel, a situation of almost continuous growth made it possible through reforms that deeply modified living conditions to diminish considerably its revolutionary ardour. Now, in view of this, one can discern the raison d'etre for the social intention of the theory of myths, i.e. that bourgeois hegemony was not about to collapse by its own volition, given that proletarian violence predicated on material exigences would not elevate the proletariat to the level of historical force capable of producing a new civilization and socialist politicians inclined towards compromise with the bourgeoisie. A total moral revolt would replace the struggle for better conditions. The psychological method would replace the traditional economistic approach and irrationalism would be placed in a classical Marxist context of socialism. In short, given that the proletariat cannot be motivated by reason, socialism remained fixated on material improvement. Capitalism was not on the verge of collapse, and the polarization of the classes did not materialize. So Sorrell mooted the need to manufacture a form of revolution attuned to the changing social reality. This was a function of the theory of myths that lay at the heart of the anti-materialist revision of Marxism. Now, Sternhell detects Marxism being cognizant of the, you know, of deploying a mythical interpretation of Marxism. Now, Sorrell's initial thinking, you know, vis-a-vis Marxism's symbolic and mythical aspect, was that Marx's theory of classes is essentially an intellectual construction, a methodological necessity. Sorrell put it thus: the Marxist theory of classes is an abstraction, and that the dichotomous division of society, an essential feature in Marx's earth, does not have a concrete existence. Moreover, Sorrell opined that the excessive complexity of the social structure, you know, presented a major impediment if one conceptualized this as, to adopt Durkheim's time, a social fact. Now, Sternhell argues that Sorrell's solution to this dichotomous division was to conceptualize it in terms of being a methodological necessity rather than a social reality, and that Sorrell drew an analogy between Marx's conception of class struggle and an artistic image intended to make us assimilate an idea. It was in this manner that the notion of class struggle could be understood by the proletariat. As Sternhell notes, such an abstraction facilitated the situating of social conflicts within a theoretical framework, you know, that possessed both mobilizing and ideological value, as it allowed social conflicts to be organized in an entirely coherent view of history. Now, Sternhell indicates that Marx considered all the hypotheses underlying the concept of the future in Marx of little interest if taken literally. However, Sorrell placed more emphasis on its mythical aspect, arguing that if one viewed Capital as, quote, this apocalyptic text, as a product of the spirit, as an image created for moulding consciousness, is a good illustration of the principle on which Marx believed he should base the rules of the action of the proletariat. Now, Sorrell held that a myth is essentially a symbol whose function is to transpose relationship of ideas into relationship of facts, which are their image. Moreover, Sternhell cites Kahn, who posits myth becoming manifest when symbols assume a narrative and dramatic form and consequently involve characters in action. And Sorrell's notion of the revolutionary strike can be held to fulfill this criterion. Furthermore, Sternhell postulates Sorrell understood there was no relationship between the truth of a doctrine, in this instance, Marxism, and its operational value as a weapon of combat. And Sternhell further argues that Sorrell was acutely aware of the power and role of myth as a motive force for social mobilization. Apropos the Marxist analysis of capitalism and its veracity as a scientific explanation that provided explanations that had universal validity, Sorrell was of the view that these debates beside the main point regarding the revolutionary action of the proletariat. Now, in his reflections, Sorrell deployed myth as an operational concept that generates action. Now, Sternhell declares that Sorrell removed myth from the realm of the intellect and relocated in that of affectivity and activity, and posits Sorrell's conception of myth as being both a new type of thought and the stimulus to a new type of political action. He encapsulates it thus: a religious way of thinking. This resonates with Kolakowski's characterization of Sorrell as a Jansenist Marxist that rebelled against the rationalistic, and as he further argues, Sorrell's notion of myth was intended to mobilize their masses and change the world, but it possessed an inexhaustible source of regeneration, moral improvement, and heroism. Moreover, owing to the irrational components of myth, social polarization was affected. Class struggle, which the mechanism of capitalism were unable to bring about, became a historical force. Furthermore, as Sternhell observes, myth has the advantage of being totally immune to failure. As Kolakowski opined, the myth is proof against argument, discussion, or discussion. Moreover, Sternhell emphasized that Sorrell neither analyzed the concept of myths nor attempts to define the term myth. His myth was on, sorry, his focus was on its social utility. Searle's myths were social myths, a means of influencing the present, and Searle's rationale is captured in the following passage from Searle, cited by Sternhell. This is what Searle said. Myths must be regarded as a way of influencing the present. Any discussion about relating them to the course of history is senseless. It's only the myth as a whole that matters. Its parts are of interest only insofar as it set off the idea contained in its construction. There is therefore little use in speculating about the incidents that can happen in the course of the social struggle, about the crucial conflicts that can bring victory to the proletariat. Even if the revolutionaries would be entirely mistaken in fantasizing about the general strike, this idea could be a factor of the utmost importance. Pardon me, in the process of preparing the revolution, if it embodies in a perfect manner all the aspirations of socialism, and it gives revolutionary thought as a whole a precision and exactitude that other ways of thinking could not have provided. It's of little importance if the general strike is only a partial reality and only a product of the popular imagination. The question is whether the general strike contains all that the socialist doctrine expects of the revolutionary proletariat. Now, it's important to note that Searle differentiates myth from utopia. While Searle concedes that up until the time he was writing Reflections, it was prepared for any myths to be entirely devoid of any utopian admixture, he continued the observation that the present-day revolutionary myths were almost devoid of it. Searle viewed utopia as an intellectual construction that can be refuted and steers the proletariat to reforms, while our present myths lead people to prepare themselves for a battle to destroy what exists. Kolakowski elaborates on the difference between myth and utopia in Searle's understanding of the terms. Unlike utopia, myth is not the description of a perfect future, but a call to a decisive battle. It's not a scientific prediction, but a force inspiring and organizing militant consciousness of a self-contained group. More important, in opposition to utopias, myth is negative, regarding the world as a coherent whole that can only be destroyed root and branch. It must be wholly accepted or rejected. Furthermore, in contradistinction to the utopians who attempt to prognosticate, the myth is an act of creation, not of prediction. Moreover, Kolakowski further observes that Searle's myth of a general strike encompasses the idea of socialism and the self-conscious of the proletariat, and the latter, uncoupling itself from society, attaining liberation without external aid. Searle believed that the proletariat must preserve its exclusively working-class character by keeping out intellectuals whose leadership would bring about the establishment of hierarchies and creating divisions amongst the workers. Now, Kolakowski notes that while Searle opines that proletarians have no moral scruples vis-à-vis other classes, he cautions that does not mean that Searle believed that the proletariat was neither amoral or immoral. The basic purpose of the revolution and the revolutionary period and the preparatory period is to effect a moral transformation of the working class that will restore its dignity, pride, independence, and sense of mission and exclusivity. Furthermore, whilst Reflections is largely an apology for violence, Searle regards violence as being morally right only insofar as it plays part in the moral education of its users. Now, in a crucial passage of Reflections, Searle identifies the role of violence in the following terms. This violence forces capitalism to preoccupy itself entirely with its material role and restores to it the bellicose qualities that it formerly possessed. A growing and solidly organized working class can force the capitalist class to remain vigilant in industrial combat. If in the face of a bourgeois that is wealthy and eager for conquest, a united and revolutionary proletariat rises up and capitalist society attains its historical perfection. Thus, proletarian violence has become a central factor of Marxism. We should add, once again, it would have the effect, if properly employed, of suppressing parliamentary socialism, which would no longer be considered the master of the working class and the guardian of order. Moreover, as noted by Finlay, Searle does not view violence solely in instrumental terms. Sterne argues that Sorrel viewed it as possessing moral value, and that it serves the primary interest of civilization, and appears as something very beautiful and very heroic, on the grounds that not only can proletarian violence ensure the future revolution, but it seems to be the only means by which European nations, deadened by humanism, can retain their former energy. And he draws a parallel, the heroes of Thermopylae, who helped maintain the light in the ancient world. Now, considering this, Sternal opines that Troll views war as a source of morality par excellence, and cites Sol's contention that lofty moral convictions do not depend on reasoning or on the training of the individual will. They depend on the state of war in which men participate, and which is expressed in precise myths. Both Rune and Sternhell emphasize Sorrel's focus, intense focus on the sublime in the reflections. Sternhell notes that Sorrel mentions the sublime 14 times in 11 pages of reflections, where Sorrel deals with this question. And further notes that Sorrel deploys it as a synonym for the epic, the heroic, and with sacrifice, abnegation, altruism. That morals can only exist when people live the hard life of the combatant and when this sense of duty is paramount. And Rune conjectures that this obsession with the motive of sublimity and of Homeric virtues is key to the most of his social philosophy, and further conjectures that Sorrel's hostility to the bourgeoisie can be related to what appears to be their decadence, that the race of bold captains who made the greatness of modern industry disappear to make way for an ultra-civilized aristocracy which has to be allowed to live in peace. However, Sorrel detected elements of the old dynamic bourgeois in the USA. And he draws an analogy between the Yankee, ready for any kind of enterprise, and the ancient Greek sailor, sometimes a colonist or merchant. Moreover, Sorrel viewed this as the exception rather than the rule. The warlike spirit had already disappeared and been replaced by a diluted and complacent conformity. Now, as previously noted, Sternhell detects the morality proselytized by Sorrel as being only present when people live the hard life of the combatant, and the sense of duty is paramount. It's the antithesis of utilitarianism, materialism, egoism, and probabilism. Hence, Sorrel's notion of the general strike, where the struggle is fiercest, and the consequences are far-reaching, and gives rise to the sublime. Now, Sorrel differentiates not only between two kinds of general strike, the political and the proletarian. The former is both called and orchestrated by a politician with a particular end in view, and if successful, strengthens the politician. But the proletarian strike is successful if the state is weakened and the proletarian institutions fortified. But he also differentiates between two different kinds of war: the heroic, celebrated by poets and inspiring the noblest and purest sentiments, and the war to divide the adversary's spoils and to allow the politicians to satisfy their ambitions. And Sorrel situates the proletarian general strike within the ancient tradition. As Sorrel puts it, the proletariat organizes itself for battle, subordinating all social considerations to that of combat. It's a very clear sentiment of the glory attached to its heroic role and the heroism of its militant attitude. It aspires to the crucial test which will give it the full measure of its value. Now, Sorrel is notable for his hostility to the Jacobinism of the French Revolution. He has only distinguished proletarian violence, a violence he characterised as being notable for its lack of ill will and brutality, from the bourgeois deployment of force, which he viewed as a form of state terrorism. But he also distinguished it from revolutionary terror as practised by Robespierre. He grouped the socialist leader Juarez with the former, referring to Juarez's history of the French Revolution. And he charges Juarez of having mixed a philosophy sometimes worthy of Monsieur Pantalon with the politics of a purveyor of guillotines, and cast him as a prototype of the bloodthirsty politician, as the terrorists of 1793. And opined that proletarian violence had no need for blood to be shot in torrents. These are neither the words nor the sentiments of someone who advocates violence for the sake of violence. According to Sternhell, a summary of Sorrel's thought can be discerned in his celebrated article, for his Apology for Violence, published in Lamartine in 1908. In this article, he conceptualized the strike as being an aspect of war, and social revolution as an adjunct to this war, and every major strike in an event. And once again, morality is to the fore in Sorrell's thinking. He envisaged this social war, calling forth the honour that develops so naturally in every organised army, confirming on revolutionary syndicalism a great civilising value, akin to when war gave the ancient republicans the ideas that are the ornaments of modern culture. Moreover, Sorrell proclaimed the syndicalist notion of socialism that can be summed up as the idea, the expectations, the preparation of a general strike, and that performing what he characterised as grave, fearful and sublime work, raise themselves above our frivolous society and make themselves worthy of teaching the world new paths. Sorrell averred that to ensure the preservation of immorality, it was important to change its motivations. Now, Sternhell summarised it thus. Arouse violence, destroy utilitarianism, materialism, liberalism and democracy, corruption and corrupting by nature, and suppress the base and servile parliamentary socialism. Now, both Kolakowski and Sternhell draw attention to the importance of pessimism in Sorrell's revision of Marxism. According to Sorrell, his reflection is predicated on pessimism, which he says is a doctrine without which nothing very lofty is achieved in the world. And he further opines that the reason that why Greek philosophy did not have great moral results because generally highly optimistic. Socrates was sometimes an almost intolerable degree. And Kolakowski observed that Sorrell deploys the terms optimism and pessimism in a special sense. Regarding those he designed to be optimisms, it includes not only Socrates, but also the Jesuits, the philosopher, the philosophes, the ideologists of the French Revolution, the utopians, believers in progress, socialist politicians, and warriors. Whilst the pessimists in Sorrell's pantheon include the early Christians, Protestants, Jansenists, and Marxists. Now, according to Kolakowski, Sorrell viewed optimists as viewing the existence of evil in the world in terms of inadequate legislation, lack of enlightenment, and human feeling. The remedy there being legal reform. But Sorrell was alert to what might be conceptualized as intended consequences, i.e. the delusions and ignorance of social reality led them to adopt terror like those of the revolution. Unlike the optimists, Sorrell portrays pessimists as ensuring any all-embracing theory on infallible method or reducing method into the universe. He regards social conditions as forming an indivisible whole that cannot be reformed piecemeal, but must be either left alone or destroyed by a catastrophic explosion. I'm just checking. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, but are you finished?
Yeah, sorry, Adam, you're the chair.
Yeah, are you finishing soon? Because I've been.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. I am getting very close.
Some of us are listening very patiently and with great interest, but we sort of wonder how long this is going to go on for.
Oh, sorry, I'll bring it to a close as soon as I can. I do apologise. Okay. I'll try and bring it to a close. Yeah?
Yeah, okay, because you've been speaking for an hour and 10 minutes.
I didn't realise.
Okay, carry on.
Yeah. In summary, the morality of what Sorrell calls the producers, that is the proletariat, they betoken a new authenticity, a sign of a new heroic culture. I'm going to skip ahead a bit now. Yeah. Sorrell is basically arguing it's not a matter of knowing what is the best morality, but only of determining if there exists a mechanism capable of developing morality. Now, Sorrell opined that reflections reveal the true nature of violence. Not only destructive, violence would be productive, not nihilistic. And Sorrell declared that the strike is a phenomenon of war, undertaking a serious, formidable, and sublime work. The socialists raise themselves above our frivolous society and make themselves worthy of putting out new roads to the world. Right, okay, I'm coming to a conclusion. Now, given the examinations of Arendt's arguments, and this critique undertaken by Finlay, the analysis of Sorrell's reflections by Berlin and McInnes, and the situating of Sorrell in both historic and philosophical context, I've tried to demonstrate that far from advocating violence for its own sake, Sorrell's reflection is both instrumental and symbolic. Moreover, Morality pervades his advocacy of violence. As Kolakowski argues, his Marxism can be deemed to be Jansenist. Regarding Arendt's assertions, the devil resides in the lack of detail. A polemic on violence is essentially just that, a polemic. Nuance is unnoticeable for its absence, whilst Reflections is also a polemic. It's a considered piece of work that needs to be viewed in terms of Sorrell's wider oeuvre. It can be argued that Sorrell is, to quote Shakespeare, King's Lear, more sinned against than sinning. That whether Arendt has misunderstood Sorrell's position in Reflection or willfully misrepresented him is a moot point. However, her characterization of Sorrell has become an orthodoxy, a taken for granted tenet. I'll end it at that point, if I may.